Taking a deeper dive at what made the headlines this month and why. Typically, our month in review show sticks mostly to the news stories that originate in Maine. But today we'll discuss the shooting in Maryland at the Capitol newspaper and the news that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is stepping down, which will put Senator Susan Collins once again in the national spotlight. Way back on June 12th here in Maine, we had a primary election, and it made the state the first in the nation to use ranked choice voting. We'll talk about those election results. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me in our panel of editorial page editors as we analyze the news stories that made the headlines in June. Which stories mattered most to you? Tariffs on lobsters? Clean election funds being held up? Or looser restrictions on medical marijuana? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. This is our month in review show, but in just the last 24 hours, there has been enough new news to fill up today's show. There was yet another mass shooting, and the retirement of a Supreme Court justice, and the failure of the head of Maine's DHHS to appear at a government oversight committee. These are just some of the stories we'll talk about with our panel of editorial page editors today. In the studio with me, Ben Bragdon. He's with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, as well as Central Maine Sunday. Ed Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young. She's with the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you which stories from this month mattered most to you. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. So as I said, we do try to focus on Maine news, but we're going to talk a little bit about yesterday's shooting in Annapolis at the Capitol newspaper. So the shooting was apparently in reaction to the paper's coverage of the shooter's criminal record, and obviously he was targeting journalists, and the three of you are our news editors whose job is to express your opinion. So what is your reaction to this as journalists? Are we in an era where journalists are at more risk?
I think the first thing we need to keep in mind is this unfortunately shows a growing pattern of how we settle disputes in America. If you do something I don't like or you spurn me or whatever I'm mad about, I'm just going to go and shoot people. And to the rest of the world, that's a pretty horrifying way to handle things. About journalism specifically, I mean, certainly we can't say that Donald Trump or the comments he makes are responsible for this shooting, but they contribute to an environment where journalists are targeted, journalists aren't respected, and treated as if, in his own words, we're the enemy. And, you know, we have a governor who said he wanted to shoot the Bangor Daily News as political cartoonist. Mm-hmm. He wanted to blow up the Portland Press Herald building. If there's anything positive to come out of the shooting at the Capitol Gazette, we've seen the outpouring today of support for journalists. You know, every day we don't come to work for fame or lots of money. We're a watchdog on government and on society, and we report on what's happening in our local communities. And without the work we do, our citizenry wouldn't be informed to take action, whether that's voting or whether that's protesting. And so hopefully people will come to understand, you know, we're not doing this because we support Democrats or Republicans or have a point of view. We're reflecting back to our readers and our listeners what is happening in our community. And just a little plug, you know, people really want to support us. You know, make sure you buy a subscription to any of the newspapers, pay for digital access, donate to Maine Public. The work we do is incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel there's fear or caution?
Well, I mean, threats are just kind of a way of life in the news business now, particularly over social media. I think type of threats they're just kind of a part of the job now. And I think if you ask most journalists, they would say that they try to push this thing to the back of their mind and not think about what may happen, but that they're not they've always, you know, thought about it before. They've thought about this sort of thing happening before, and now that it does, you can't help but be a little shaken by it. I mean, we do live in a very safe world, and these things don't happen very often. And you know, going to work as a journalist is still pretty safe, but having watched what happened yesterday, it kind of you know, makes all your worst fears kind of come true. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to hard to think that doesn't have some sort of effect on how you approach the job.
How about you, Greg?
I mean, I think Ben's right. This is a very safe state to live in, and it's a fairly safe profession, and even with what happened yesterday. I think Susan made a really good point that I've been thinking about a lot lately, is our inability to resolve disputes, you know, the kind of places where differences used to get ironed out, places like the legislature, you know, elections, these things are just not, people are just walking away mad and not kind of sort of taking a loss and moving on to the next thing. I think what I'm seeing a lot, you know, certainly we deal with a lot of angry people, and there's a lot of anger in our society. And what I'm seeing is people have a story that explains to them how the world works. And I don't mean to say that they're, you know, they're wrong. I have my own story. And as new information comes in, we all plug it in to our story. And if it doesn't fit, we have to come up with a reason why it doesn't fit. And one of the things the newspaper and, you know, all news media does is present new facts. And it sometimes people find it very disturbing, you know. And so we deal with a lot of people who are angry and who think that we're, you know, making stuff up or purposely getting stuff wrong. Or and the fact is you know, this is just human nature. You're imperfect, and we're just trying to get, you know, tell stories and understand, you know, build understanding. So,
Okay. There's another national story with local relevance. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has announced he will retire, and that has set into motion a flurry of speculation about his replacement. And Senator Susan Collins, as well as Senator Angus King, are viewed as powerful voices in the fight over the next Supreme Court justice. Susan, can you talk about that, about Collins' role in this, looking forward?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost immediate that interest groups were putting pressure on her to, number one, uphold the standard that Mitch McConnell set a couple years ago when he refused to hold hearings on President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. And because it's an election year, we shouldn't hold hearings or have a vote on President Trump's nominee. So they want her to obstruct that, which is very unlikely. The second prong is that she should oppose any nominee who would overturn Roe v. Wade. She said, you know, she won't have a litmus test, but she's in a really tough position, is going to get a lot of scrutiny as the left sees her as one of two senators who maybe might kind of could oppose a Trump nominee. But I mean, at the end of the day, she's a Republican, and she tends to go along with Republicans. So we'll see who the president nominates and how it plays out. But she'll be under a lot of scrutiny throughout this process.
And people are going to be barraging her offices like they did last time with Gorsuch, right?
Right. Probably
I'm sure
more
they
so.
Already are.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
You know, there's only a handful of people in the country who could do anything to stop a Trump nominee, and she's one of them. And for her to say, you know, from the outset that she's not going to have a different standard for this judge than she's had in the past, I think it sends the message that, she, you know, if he sends up somebody who's got the right kind of pedigree and doesn't have a big record, you know, she'll ask a few questions about you know, judicial restraint, and she'll vote for them because she's voted for there's four anti-abortion judges on the Supreme Court right now. She's voted for three of them, and she's also voted for two pro-choice judges. You know, so her standard, you know, is pretty well established, and she said she's not going to do anything different this time.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the big difference here, of course, is that people see this a vote for this next nominee, whoever it is the same thing as a vote against Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. because people are see the danger that this next nominee could put that ruling in, and so they're expecting her to take a different tact with this one, to hold this nominee to a different standard. And like Greg said, there's no indication she's going to do that. So that's going to be the friction point for the mm-hmm. next few months. And, you know, we're going to see this play out very quickly, it looks like.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, fast and furious.
I mean, I'm sure she saw when the news came across the wire that Kennedy was retiring. She thought, well, you know, there goes my summer.
Yeah.
If she was ever going to have any chance to have a quiet summer, that was over the second he retired.
Right, that's for sure. So we welcome you to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. And here locally, yesterday's news was that the Maine Government Oversight Committee met to discuss what steps DHHS needs to take to fix how they deal with child abuse and protection. And then this, of course, is in the wake of the deaths of the two young girls from child abuse. But the committee, I guess, reacted pretty angrily when DHHS Acting Commissioner Ricker Hamilton did not show up. So what's up with that?
Well, the Government Oversight Committee they've ordered, you know, two investigations of the child welfare system, one specifically into the deaths of the two young girls who died this year, and another one into the system as a whole. And while those are going on, they're also working on legislation. And they want to be able to get this legislation ready for upcoming session. And obviously, it's an urgent matter. There's some real problems with the child welfare system. We think we have some sort of idea about what's going on there, but there's a lot of specifics to be hammered out. And in order to do that, you really need the commissioner of DHHS and the LePage administration involved to give information on what their programs are, and what their staff levels are like, and what their caseloads are like. Because from the outside, it looks like the child welfare system is overburdened. Mm-hmm. Their calls are way up, their reports are way up, their investigations are way up. We've talked to caseworkers who feel like they just can't give each case the attention it deserves. But the governor hasn't really talked about that at all.
Last month, though, didn't he say, you know, this needs to be fixed?
Yeah, he thinks that he has some ideas, and he's been really pressing. He wants to change the policy towards family reunification, and he wants to have harsher penalties on people who see something and don't report it. But that really doesn't get to the heart of the issue. It seems like a lot of people saw this, and it seems like it was reported. It just seems like something was missed somewhere, and he seems like the governor is completely dismissing that side of things, mm-hmm. the side of things that says he didn't take care of the child welfare system. He allowed it to get overburdened, and now we have two girls dead, and that's the problem. And so the commissioner was supposed to go yesterday and explain some of those things. He would have faced questions that I just brought up, and he said he was going to show up, it seems like. And when the meeting came, he didn't come. So they've subpoenaed him, and he has to come, I think, July 10th. But who knows how the governor's going to react to that.
Okay, we'll see what happens with that. The legislature, I guess, has met for a special session, sort of on again, off again. It's a little bit unclear what has been accomplished and what's still left. Greg, do you want to try to sort through that?
They have avoided some of the worst nightmare scenarios regarding payment for direct care workers, and those were were going to result in people losing their jobs right around July 1st, and people going without care. There's a great number of things that are still left unresolved. I don't think they've gotten anywhere on bonds. Is that right?
No,
you know,
no.
It's hard to keep track. I mean, you make a list of the things they're not doing is much harder than to list the ones that they have. They failed to do a very simple typo fix on the Clean Elections Act that will mean that candidates won't get money that they're qualified to get come next month. And that is something that was driven by the governor. And it's, as with so many of these cases, it's a case of people using maximum leverage whenever they can to stop the process, to try to exact some kind of concession later. And it's unclear where that's going, but they'll have to come back. I think there's some things that'll get were passed that will be vetoed, and that always means more legislature.
Really dragging out. Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned the clean election. So is a lawsuit now out there, mm-hmm, against Governor LePage?
Yes.
What's going on with that?
By the Clean Elections Act. So aside from this this typo issue, the legislature, I mean, the governor can authorize the spending of money that was sent to other candidates last election in 2016. And it wasn't used and sent back to the state. So this money is sitting in an account, a Clean Elections account, and all they need is a note from the governor saying go ahead and spend it, and he refuses. And he's among other things, he's refusing to issue bonds that were approved, as claiming that the legislature is spending too much money, so that he can't, in good conscience, spend this money. But it's money that's sitting in an account. He's not saving anybody a dime. He's not
The $5 donations that people. This is
money that was given to campaigns in 2016, mm-hmm, and not spent. At the end of the campaign, they account for every dime, and whatever they didn't spend, they return to the state. And so this is money that was returned to the state that was not needed last time.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, it's time for a quick break, and we will talk about the fact that we had primaries this month. That was ages ago. But after our break, we'll take your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does DeMont Associates, philanthropic advisors promoting youth in philanthropy with their annual scholarship. Nominations at DeMontAssociates.com.
Power dynamics shape everything in our lives. From high school...
You're wearing sweatpants.
So? So that's against the rules, and you can't sit with us.
To the U.S. Senate.
The senator will take her seat.
To the way we feel about ourselves.
Power does make us a little bit more self-focused, but this can happen to us all. This is just what the mind does when we feel powerful.
This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Hidden Brain Sunday morning at 11 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Living on Earth, a warming planet brings a higher risk of devastating corn crop failures.
Globally, the people who would be impacted most by this are people who spend the majority of their income on food. Those people generally tend to be most vulnerable to climate change to begin with.
And corn is the world's biggest crop. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Living on Earth, Sunday morning at 7 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, the news that made Maine headlines in June. Joining me are three editorial page editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And it feels like ages ago, but we did have a primary election here in Maine, and we made national news when we put ranked choice voting into action this month. So from a logistical point of view, it seemed like ranked choice voting did work the way it was supposed to. You want to talk about how that turned out?
Sure. I mean, it worked exactly the way they said it was going to work. It took a while to assemble the votes, and Secretary of State Matt Dunlap was very careful about the process of counting them for the first time, make sure that there wasn't, a big anomaly. I found it funny that the week going into the election, people were talking about how this was going to cause chaos, and it was going to have last place people were going to finish in first place, and all kinds of crazy things were going to happen. And then after the votes were counted, the same people said nothing happened. The same people who won on election night won after the ranked choice rounds were run, and nobody even changed place. It was a waste. So I think ranked choice voting is not like a radical idea. I think people about 200,000 people filled out a ranked choice ballot. Very few of them couldn't figure out how to do it. And I think everybody I talked to actually kind of liked having more choice, more say.
Here's what our some of our listeners on Facebook, Kyle on Facebook said, what did we learn from ranked choice voting? That we don't need it, and it cost us more to do it. While Jason on Facebook said, it proved that people will lie and twist information in order to fool the people. We have voted for it twice now, given the state leadership a mandate, yet our state leadership doesn't seem to acknowledge mandates from the people, as evidenced by the repeated failure of this leadership to allow the binds the main people have, people have voted on to be issued. It also proves that if the people of Maine work together, we can override this situation. And it made a difference too, though, didn't it, that Democrats, I read, tended to rank more, use the ranked choice voting more, whereas Republicans voting tended to just pick one.
I mean,
person.
I think we don't really know because, certainly all the Republican candidates were telling their people to just rank one. But since they didn't run the ballots, do we know if Republicans ranked? I think we don't. I mean,
Susan,
I think,
did you have information on that? I thought you had an analysis in your paper about part of the reason why.
No, I mean, as Greg said, they didn't have to do ranked choice voting in the Republican primary. So we don't know and that data exists if the Secretary of State wanted to take a look at it. But because there was no need to go through the ranked choice voting process because Sean Moody had, mm-hmm. I believe, 56% in the first round. Mm-hmm. They didn't. So I don't think we really know. But it's interesting. We're starting to hear from people who are learning that we're not going to use ranked choice voting for the governor's election in November. And a lot of people are pretty frustrated about that because they liked the process. They thought that it worked well and they're looking forward to doing it again in the governor's race in November. And you know, we can't because it violates the state constitution.
So which races will still be some ranked choice voting, right?
For races for Congress.
Mm-hmm. Congressional district race.
Yeah, Congress and U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the results of the primary election. The gubernatorial candidates, Janet Mills, Sean Moody, was that any surprise?
Not really. I mean, it seemed that they were kind of on the top of everybody's list. I think maybe the size of Moody's victory was a little bit of a mm-hmm. surprise to people. Maybe the ease with which Mills won. It was a fairly close race, but I think people thought that was closing towards the end. And even the last couple of weeks, there was a lot of talk about Mark Eaves. Maybe he'd pull off this surprise, but I think that was just a result of not really knowing anything and people having to talk a lot before the election and say something, and that kind of made it sound interesting.
So but, that's how it works.
These things always look so obvious in hindsight. I mean, it looks obvious that Sean Moody was the one that the Republicans were going to go for. He's the most obvious heir to LePage, and he's got a lot of things going for him in the general election, and that just sets up a really, really kind of interesting race for governor. You know, we have Hillary Clinton won the state fairly easily, even though Donald Trump took the second district, but LePage won his last election pretty easily. So, which one of those things comes out in November? You know, I don't know. I don't have a good guess at that. Do any of you?
You guys want to weigh in?
I mean, the pattern is that in years when you have a governor's race, the off-year or mid-year elections, Democrats get a much lower turnout than they do in presidential years. And I've been trying to figure out, you know, who those people are and, you know, what motivates them. And somebody explained to me it's kind of hard to do in Maine because in states where there's very low voter turnout, it's easy to find the infrequent voters. But in a place like Maine, where we have, you know, among the top voter turnout in the country in presidential years, it's harder to find the non-voters. It tends to skew in the off years, tends to skew for Republicans. And that's going to be, I think, a challenge, especially with two independents in the race. No ranked choice voting, and the two independents, Alan Caron and Terry Hayes, are both former Democrats who, you know, at least in theory, are appealing to some of the same pool of voters that would appeal to Janet Mills.
I'm sure we'll be talking about that on our next month in review. We'll go to a call from Jim in Presque Isle. Hi, Jim. What's your question? Jim, hi. You're on the air. Oops. Maybe we don't have Jim quite yet. Let's go to Michael in Dover, New Hampshire. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I tell you, I'm so distressed at everything that I hear going on with Trump and with the right wing. I consider myself a pretty left-wing liberal, but I also consider myself someone who can listen to reasonable arguments and have a decent conversation. But I don't see that happening anymore with people on the right. They're name-calling, they're belittling, they're stoking the fans of racism. I've heard people say things like, all Mexicans are. And I when I hear the word all or never, I cringe, because it's just not the way it is. But this is the stuff that Trump seems to stoke. I can't imagine we have a president who is an outright racist, who really believes some of the things that he's saying. But I think he stokes the base of support of the white supremacist, white nationalist movement in America, and it's so dangerous what he's doing. Even when he stokes the flames of the Christian, I call them Christian nationalists in America.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael, for sharing your thoughts. And we have talked about the divisiveness here, the climate in our country and in Maine to some degree.
Sure. There's a lot of anger out there.
Yeah.
And, since the beginning of time, there's been people who will use the threat of outside invasion and the barbarians at the border to their advantage, and it's happened in U.S. history, it's happened in world history, and it becomes even more acute at times when there are big changes going on in a country, and there's some really big changes going on in our country. The demographics are changing. The white majority is getting smaller, and there was really an opening for someone to take advantage of that. And the president, however he feels personally, I personally don't think he really has any values. He just has a way to, things that he uses to get his way, and he's really good at this, and he's found this real wedge issue. He's very comfortable talking about it. He started this whole thing with the child separation at the border, and it looks, the reaction to it looks awful for him, but it really isn't. He seems like he's very comfortable as immigration as an issue going into the going into the midterm election, and whether that works or not could kind of be this tipping point in where we go as a country.
Okay, we have a call from Betsy Sweet. She's on the line. Hi, Betsy. Would you like to share your thoughts?
Oops.
Having some phone issues here. Let's try going back to Jim in Presque Isle. Hi, Jim. Are you on the line?
I am. Hello.
Okay. What's your question?
The quick statement is that a well-run primary is crucial to our country's stability and the compromise within each party. In 2016, a Wasserman-Clinton cartel actively worked against Bernie Sanders during the primary. Why didn't we not hear any discussion about that?
Okay, thanks for your question, Jim.
I mean, I heard a lot of discussion about it, and in fact, I'm still hearing a lot of discussion, and it's I'm surprised by how people are not, moving on from this. The idea that, there's a Hillary party and a Bernie party, and they haven't come together. Is still playing a role in 2018. It's interesting.
Susan, did you have something to talk about on that front?
I would echo what Greg said. I mean, it certainly was reported on, and we heard and read a lot about it. So it's a little surprising to hear that people weren't aware of that split and the allegations that it was rigged against Bernie. I just have to bring up one of my pet peeves. Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. He's never been a Democrat. He's not a member of the Democratic Party. So, of course, the party can do what they want. But I just find it amusing that, you know, he's again under consideration to be their presidential candidate when he's not even a member of their party. It just seems very odd to me.
So let's loop back.
Donald Trump was really a Republican before he ran.
Fair enough.
Everybody's very open minded these days.
So a little bit more about the local election results. What about the second congressional district? Was that a surprise?
I don't think so. I mean, folks up here in the second district, the conventional wisdom, there wasn't polling because it was a primary, and it's really hard to get accurate numbers when you have such a small sample size. But the conventional wisdom was that Jared would do well, and he did. When you look at some of the town-by-town breakdowns, however, it's interesting to see where Lucas St. Clair did well. You know, of course, this was only Democratic voters, but a lot of people thought that there would still be ill will in the communities around the National Monument. But, you know, he did very well in East Millinocket and Patton and Holton and Sherman. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting for Jared going forward. You know, he never talked much about the monument, but does that become part of his campaign to begin talking about that and its value? Because certainly there are voters that see it as a very positive thing.
Okay. We actually have Betsy Sweet back on the line. I hope this works. Hi, Betsy. Are you there?
Hi, I'm here. How are you guys?
Good.
Hello.
Good, 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 good. Well, I thought I would just weigh in, having just been through this primary, on a couple of things. And, you know, one is how appalling and outraged we should all be about what's happening with clean elections. Because it's not just sort of a news story. This is a contract that the state entered in with candidates. Now, I'm not in it anymore. But it's a contract. And, you know, people decide whether or not to run clean elections based on the amount of money they're going to get. And so for one person or one caucus to hold up this is just so appalling, but that's not why I really called. I really wanted to talk about ranked choice voting. And, you know, somebody, I don't remember who it was, said that, you know, it didn't make much of a difference. I just want to say, from being on the campaign trail, there is nothing further than the truth, from the truth. First of all, I think it changed everybody's interest in all the candidates. And I think we have a lot to learn, I think, as candidates. And I think, honestly, with all due respect to all of you, from the press on how to cover this, there was a man who covered us, who covered Mark Eaves and I from The Economist from England. And he said to me, Ms. Sweet, why is it that you are not the story of this race? Because I went from zero, nobody knowing who I was. I didn't even register on anybody's polls. And many of the first polls I wasn't even considered, to coming in third. And it took Janet four rounds of voting to get over 50%, which I'm 100% behind her. I can't wait to support her. But that's a huge story that I think was missed, not just about me, but just about what happened with ranked choice. And while the end result was the same, I think what happened in between, the issues that we talked about, the issues that the candidates had to address, were completely changed and different. And I think people felt much more empowered in this race. So I think it was a huge success. And I think as candidates and the press learn how to cover this kind of voting and this kind of campaigning differently, I think it's going to be even more benefit. You know, one of the things that I'd love your thoughts on this. One of the things that was pretty clear to me as a candidate is that from day one, the press had decided that this was a horse race between Janet Mills and Adam Cody. And no matter what anybody else did, what Mark Eaves did or Mark Dion or I or Diane, anybody, no matter what we did, we couldn't break through that story. And I remember one of the financing reporting periods, I actually came in second to Adam Cody. And one of the papers said, which was a surprise to everyone, and had beat out Janet Mills in that particular reporting period. And at 10 of midnight, I saw the headline and I called and I said, your headline's just not right. I mean, Janet didn't, they're not first and second. I actually came in second. And they're like, what? You know, but in the heads of people, this was always a horse race between two people. And I think in ranked choice voting, we have a responsibility to educate people about all the candidates, because I think that would make a big difference. So I think it's something for all of us to learn. But I just want to say, I couldn't disagree more that ranked choice voting didn't really have an impact.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Betsy, and sharing your thoughts. And we'll get some more comments from you guys about that after the break. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
What is the impact of immigration on the U.S. economy?
Immigrants, like the rest of us, are sensible people. They're here for economic reasons. They want jobs. If jobs aren't available, they'd go back home.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, the data and personal stories behind immigration, and the story of a musician who's made all of New England his home.
I say that I've kind of found a way to monetize restlessness.
Please join us.
Next is coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
While doing time in a federal prison, Jeff Smith met some of the most promising entrepreneurs he'd ever encountered. So when Jeff got out, he decided to tap into that hidden genius.
There's not a single concept that you'd learn at Wharton or Harvard Business School that you couldn't learn inside federal prison.
That story next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for the TED Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 1 and again Wednesday evening at 11 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we have analysis of the news of the month. With me are Greg Kesich. He's editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon is the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, as well as Central Maine Sunday. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young. She's editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Join our conversation. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And before the break, we had Betsy Sweet calling in to talk about ranked choice voting. Did you have a reaction to what Betsy was saying, Greg?
Yeah, a lot of what she said made sense. I mean, I think she's right that we don't have a particularly, good way of covering these kind of races, because this is the first time, actually the first time in the country, that a whole state has gone ranked choice. I think there's changes in the way people campaign too that impacted the coverage. People have an ability to reach out to voters through social media in a way that's not visible to the whole community the way TV ads are, and that kind of changes the nation of. It's harder to know it's harder to know who's resonating with voters and who isn't. But, I think she had a good point. I think one of the problems was there was so much news about ranked choice voting, about whether or not it was going to be in effect, that there was not enough space for people to really talk about what does it mean, how does it affect your behavior. And I think the probably the most interesting thing of the whole campaign was when Betsy Sweet and Mark Eaves announced that they were running a kind of joint campaign. They're running against each other, but saying vote for us 1 and 2 in some order, and that block of voters ended up being the block that decided the election between Janet Mills and Adam Cody, because when that vote was consolidated, and ended up with Betsy Sweet finishing third. So she's right that was in some ways the big story of the campaign. It might have been better if there hadn't been so much court back and forth. And maybe, if next time maybe a candidate, a group of candidates does that earlier in the process, that could also make a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear her talk about how ranked choice voting changed things for her on the campaign trail, and wonder what the other candidates would say, because that's one of the big promises of ranked choice voting, is that it changes how people campaign and how voters approach the race. Less about the horse race stuff and more about learning and about each candidate and about campaigning better. And it's really hard to tell whether that had an effect this time, and the candidates are still figuring out and the voters are still figuring it out. But, that's kind of one of the big questions that we won't really know until we do this a few times. And we also haven't had it on a partisan race yet, which seems to me it makes bigger difference when you have a wider range of candidates. I mean, I think most Democrats would kind of look at the Democratic field and be like, yeah, you know, policy-wise, all these people feel basically the same to me, and I might, you know, shuffle them around. But when you have, you know, say, two liberals and one conservative on the ballot, it tends to make a bigger difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look at that first LePage election when we're fighting over, well, who can win? Who can, you know, who do you vote for? Do you vote for Elliot Cutler? You know, what do you do? You don't get that as much in
like
a primary.
Right.
Right. And unfortunately, we're not going to have that in the gubernatorial race, but we will have it in, you know, the first congressional district race and the second congressional race, and see how it works out there.
Okay, we have a Facebook post from Rob. He says, I don't hear anyone talking or writing about how paper ballots save the day for RCV, for ranked choice voting. I think what happened with counting the RCV ballots showed that a paper trail is essential for any electronic voting machine.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that did work.
Right.
We're going to go to a call from, let's see, Bruce in Hancock. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
I'd like the journalist to connect Anthony Kennedy and the Citizens United decision, clean elections, and money in politics for me, if they could.
Oh,
back to
I think that's one for Susan.
Because,
I think,
yeah, Susan, go for it.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, Kennedy has this reputation as being a moderate, and certainly, you know, he was a savior to the left on social issues, on questions of equal rights, marriage, just, you know, anti-discrimination. But on a lot of corporate issues, yeah, he was pretty conservative, with Citizens United being a perfect example of that. He was also pretty terrible, if you believe in broader voting rights, in, you know, paring back voting rights. And he doesn't really see a problem with partisan gerrymandering. So, you know, we get a little glowy sometimes in praising him as such a middle-of-the-road, moderate guy, because on a lot of decisions, he wasn't moderate at all.
Okay. And I think I would add to that is that because of Citizens United and the way that money flows in to outside groups that can spend in elections that are untethered to the campaigns, we have that situation that Betsy was talking about, where we're very focused on who's raising money for their own campaign. But the very last week of this primary, an outside group, Emily's List, dropped $300,000 for negative ads against Adam Cody. And they were not TV ads. They were Facebook ads. So not everybody saw them. But you know, it's hard to believe that they didn't have some kind of impact. So that's the connection. I mean, you could have a clean elections candidate who is well-financed, but something like that comes out of the blue. There's nothing that they can do to stop it.
Huh. Okay. So,
and to go a little farther on clean elections, I mean, Betsy brought up a good point, as we have this fight over clean election funding for the next fiscal year that starts on July 1st. As Betsy said, this is money that was pledged to these candidates.
Right.
They collected their $5 qualifying contributions, turned that all in, and they were told, you're going to get this amount of money depending on what office you're running for. And for, there's two problems, as Greg pointed out. The short-term problem is the money that was supposed to be pushed out the door before tomorrow. The Ethics Commission, because they're not allowed to spend all the money they have because the governor won't sign off on it, they told candidates they're going to get 28% on average of what they're entitled to based on, you know, the division and having qualified for clean election funding. So these people have already pledged to not raise private money, and now they're only going to get a fraction of what they were entitled to. And we have no idea what happens after July 1st, because the House Republican caucus won't sign off on, as Greg pointed out, just fixing a simple drafting error in the law. So, you know, we're really doing a disservice whether you believe in clean elections or not. These candidates signed up to a system having faith that the funding would be there. And when it's not, it puts them at a huge disadvantage, which has caused some people to say this is all about Republicans trying to rig the election in their favor, because they know these candidates will be underfunded, which would be a really horrible outcome.
Except for a lot of Republicans get that money, too. And
yeah, a smaller percentage, yeah, than, especially in state legislative races, than Republicans. But yes, a lot of them do.
Okay, we have a caller now. Tom is calling from the Turnpike in Kennebunk. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Hello. Well, hello. More of a, it's a question. I need to know if your guests know what may be in the water in Gorm, since both of our leading gubernatorial candidates at some point in their lives, Gorm residents.
Is that right. Just a coincidence?
Cradle of governors.
Thanks, Tom, for calling in. And we are going to go to Russell now in Buckfield. Hi, Russell.
Hello there.
Hi. Real quick, what's your comment?
Yeah, I was listening to the program, and I kind of wanted to just say I really agree with Betsy Sweet on we really need to do our homework more. Because I actually am a Democratic ballot clerk here in Buckfield, and so I was at the election, and I found that it was really, for the Democratic ticket, very confusing because there were so many candidates, and my first choice did get in, so I was so my vote did count, but I think that Bessie was correct in saying that we really need to look at all the candidates with ranked choice more than just the one that we particularly are voting for.
Okay, right. Thanks for your call, Russell. Yeah, so it was everyone had to do their homework this time.
I mean, it's tough. How do you look at seven of anything? You know, right. How do you evaluate, your seven favorite toothpaste? I mean, it's not easy, but it is, that is sort of a task for the media is going to be how do we find a better way to compare these different, candidates.
Okay, that's going to be our final word on that. So, Susan, Ben, and Greg, thank you all for joining us today. Susan Young is the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Ben Bragdon is editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday. And Greg Kesich is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. And today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 7. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.